Accession number 27347, Reel 28.
Stanley Brand, Reel 28. What was the Firefly like as an aircraft?
Oh, it was beautiful. All the power one could want. It had a canopy, it had a cockpit heater, it had everything that the Swordfish didn't have. Retractable undercarriage, flaps, the lot. It was like going back to the Harvard in some ways, but much more business-like. It was an offensively armed... it was a carrier for offensive weapons, and it made one feel powerful. It was very much like a two-seater Spitfire. But then it came to the point of crewing up again, and this nearly broke my heart, because I couldn't see any reason why I couldn't crew up with Bill again, because Bill was redundant and looking for a new job. Johnny, of course, I didn't need an air gunner. But I couldn't see why they sent us to a crewing up centre where I had to pick on a new observer. I tried one or two and the rapport wasn't there. I eventually crewed up with somebody who I think under combat conditions I would have eventually achieved the relationships that I had with Bill. But underneath it all was a resentment against top brass, who couldn't understand that once you'd made a commitment and shared your life with somebody, that you should suddenly chop and change. Why? It was so unnecessary. Because the observers I was offered had no wartime experience. They were sprogs who were beginning to learn, and I was supposed to instruct him and form the bond. The Firefly was a lovely aircraft to fly. It was so precise, and with rockets I could hit a target with at least 4 out of the 8 rockets, a target which was about 8-foot diameter. In other words, a lorry size. I could hit a lorry with 4 out of 8 of the broadside, which was pretty good going.
How would you familiarise yourself with the Firefly at that stage? Because obviously you'd done all your pilot training, you've flown the Swordfish. What was the kind of procedure for another aircraft at that stage?
They did have twin cockpit, dual control. That's the word I was looking for. Dual control, and we did have instruction, but it was just like the Harvard, just like the Magister. Nothing abnormal about it. It was just pure dual control with an instructor who treated us as adults because of the experience that we had that he hadn't got. He was an instructor, but he hadn't the wartime experience. But there was a mutual respect. We were there to learn something from him, and he had something to offer. That does bring a mutual respect.
A much faster aircraft than the Swordfish, though.
Yes, much, much faster. I can't remember what was the normal cruising speed, because I don't know. It no longer seemed important, I suppose. When our lives depended upon it, keeping to an exact speed and an exact course had become second nature to us. But suddenly, we could be careless about it. I honestly don't remember what my cruising speed was.
But you did training for night fighter operations.
Yes, yes.
What did that entail?
A lot of work in the link trainer, blind flying, a lot of beamed approaches, a lot of control by signals into my earphones to steer a course in a beam control situation where if you varied to the left you got a series of dots, if you varied to the right you got a series of dashes, and when you were bang down the middle you got a continuous note where the dots and the dashes merged to direct us onto an intruder which was detected by radar. It was all electronics.
And were you doing that when the Japanese war ended?
Yes, when they dropped the atomic bomb. And suddenly I realised that, yes, it was over. Until we knew of the atomic bomb, we were expecting to go out any day. In fact, I was sent home on leave prior to embarkation. And then I got a message to say that my embarkation was cancelled. I was going to join Indefatigable. My cousin was just killed on the Implacable. He was flying Seafires out there, and he was doing a practice dive bomb with a Seafire, and his wings came off, or one wing came off. Which of course brought it home to me very much. It was within it was April that he was killed, and the end of the war came in August.
Were you pleased not to have had to go to the Far East?
In a way, yes, and yet I felt that I'd spent a lot of the years of my life in training and hadn't used them to the full, that the ultimate test of my training, my abilities, my personality, it had suddenly ceased. And then, of course, I began to think of civil life again. I'd been asked several times during the war why, while I wasn't keeping up with maths, physics and chemistry, because I'd been going to night school to try and get a London external BSc. I'd got my intermediate BSc through night school, and it was a case of could I keep it up. So many things had happened. I'd met the girl who was going to be my wife. I was much older. Would I be able to settle down to civilian life? Would my ICI senior manager be right in that the people who'd decided to stay in the reserved occupation had seniority over me? Whether they'd have salaries and increments that I'd never get, never catch up with them. I had second thoughts about it. I got as far as the captain secretary's door with an application for a permanent commission. And I was about to knock on the door when I realised not only had I signed my death warrant, but I'd made sure that my girlfriend wouldn't marry me, because she'd told me quite definitely that she didn't want to be a serviceman's wife all her life. So I never applied for it. And then I was offered a further education and training scheme scholarship, award, I don't know what you'd call it, to go to university, to pick up where I left off. At first, I thought it was a doddle because I'd decided that I'd like to go in for medicine. I wanted to be a surgeon. This came about because of my experience at sea, when I had at one time a medical officer who was incapable at certain times. He had malaria from his experience in the Middle East, Far East. He had a drink problem. Perhaps I should say that to go on record, because he can perhaps be traced. But when a man got his fingers caught in a winch and the MO wasn't available, I had to amputate the index and middle finger of his right hand, caught in a winch. I reckon I did it very well, because that man came to me in later years and showed me the stumps, which were nicely rounded off and tucked in and all the rest of it. He said that he had gratitude for what had happened. All my life I'd enjoyed fine work, model making, anything to do with creativity with my hands, and I decided that I would like to become a surgeon. However, they decided that I should only be financed to pick up where I left off, which was maths, physics and chemistry, so that it had to be, and I got into Durham University with that.
At that stage, were the Fleet Air Arm running down very quickly and wanting people to leave?
Yes, they wanted to get us out, and they also wanted to avoid paying us any extra earned by automatic promotions. When they demobbed me, I had a fortnight to go to get my lieutenant's stripes, which would have increased my war gratuity quite a lot. It would have increased my leave pay and allowance. They were keen to get people out, and they got me out a fortnight before I would have got out.
When was that you left? Was that 1945 or was it 46?
It was 46. April 46. It was quite a job to pick up where one had left off. There were 125 applicants for the Honours Chemistry course at Durham, and we were told on the first day that they only had places for 25 people in the final honours year, and that they were going to whittle down from 125 to 25 in the course of the 3 years. And to do that, you're going to have examinations in every subject, in every subdivision of subjects. I mean, in chemistry it was organic chemistry, inorganic chemistry, analytical chemistry, nuclear chemistry, and so on. Practical. We'd have exams in every subject, every term, and no resits. You're out on one failure. By that time, I was engaged to be married. Commitments. I'd been away from it for 4 years. We were in the 125 people, about 20% were boys straight from school. The cream, the absolute cream, as you can imagine. They were the top ranking higher school certificate boys. We were stale, had other interests, and had to compete. I didn't get any joy at all out of university because it was all panic stations. I got married at the end of my first year, where I got a first in my class. I got the professor's prize, and it should have come naturally, but from then on I was haunted with ladies who owned the houses in which they let me have rooms. Later on, when our firstborn came, our landlady said, "Oh, you'll have to keep the baby quiet. If you can't keep the baby quiet, you'll have to go." And that's the position I was in my finals, where I was faced with a daughter who was teething in rooms where we were threatened with eviction if she cried. No, they weren't the best years of my life at university. It was a challenge which had to be met, had to be overcome, just like the U-boats, it had to be overcome.
Just really one last question. How do you feel now about having served with Fleet Air Arm during the Second World War?
I'm glad that I didn't accept reserved occupation status, because I was amongst men with a capital M, people that I still feel I can look up to, and they were beyond my wildest dreams as companions. They were salt of the earth. I'm proud to have been connected to them. At times I wondered whether I deserved to be amongst them. One always had misgivings at times, especially after a near miss. You wondered whether you were competent to be amongst them. I wouldn't have missed it for anything. King Henry V's words don't come to me because I haven't a good memory, but those of you at home in England asleep, you'll regret the day that you were not with us. And it's true.